This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, we've had a couple of significant 180s this week when it comes to lockdowns, haven't we? First, yeah. St. Andrew of COVID-19 in New York State, and now our very own Mayor Triple Threat saying it's time to think about talking about reopening restaurants.
We are very close to a point where we should be talking about opening up our bars and restaurants. If we have people and give them an outlet for entertainment in the restaurant space, in the bar space, we have much more of an opportunity, in my view, to be able to regulate and control that environment.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Lori Lightfoot thinks it's time we should talk about reopening restaurant. I love the way she explains this, too. Not because we're destroying the city's economy and taking thousands of businesses away from people and reducing employment opportunities by tens of thousands more. No, but this because we'll do a better job under the auspices of safety. We'll have more control. We can get rid of these underground parties that are the super spreader events.
Yeah, and you know what? First of all, we shouldn't have been closed in the first place. And secondly, I'm all about reopening everything, schools, sports, even high school sports. But if Pritzker caves, there's going to be holy hell. Because the positivity rate, Dan, if we have to follow the metrics, Dan, I know you don't follow this because I'm a nerd and I have to go to these press conferences, but we're supposed to be 8% and under for 7 consecutive days. Some goofy thing, some arbitrary number. But he's stuck with 8%. We're at 10%, okay? Even though I think safely, I actually think bars and restaurants are already reopened anyway. But if he caves to her, then why have any rules in place anyway? Then we should just open everything right now.
Well, today is the day that our supersized governor is supposed to weigh in on this topic of reopening restaurants in certain zones to certain level, to certain
regions.
Capacity levels, right? I mean,
it's today noon.
The day?
Noon, Thompson Center. I can't wait. I'm leaving right after the show, and I'm going to sit in the front row.
That's exciting.
Well, I'm chomping at the bit because I have a lot of questions to ask him.
So he said in response to Lightfoot's statements at that press conference that he has not heard from Lightfoot, but of course he welcomes input from local officials and he looks forward to the opportunity to visit with her on the blah, 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 blah. So we'll see. He hasn't staked out a position. She really hasn't staked out a position either. Starting to talk about reopening restaurants without any specific response to, say, the Chicago Restaurants Coalition that has called anemically for restaurants to be returned to 20% capacity by now it's January 29th. You know, here's a little tip for the Chicago Restaurant Coalition. If you're going to draw a line, then man it.
Yep.
You draw a line, you erase a line, you redraw the line. That is not strengthening your bargaining position. It's also making you look weak. And frankly, you're asking for morsels from the table. You should be asking for everything on the table because it's your table that's at stake.
It's your
table.
You're begging the person who locked you in a trunk for the last 75 days to let you out early. And then when you do get let out, you know what they're going to do? They're going to hug him. I'm like, oh, isn't he great?
No, they're asking to have 25% of them let out of that trunk.
Well, here's Lori Lightfoot explaining with the reporter.
I am very, very focused on getting our restaurants reopened. If we look at the various criteria that the state has set, we are meeting if not all of those. So that's a conversation that I will have with the governor. But I want to get our restaurants and our bars reopened as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that's not true.
I said this the other day.
This is the part.
You know, the restaurant setting in particular, highly regulated. We have inspections on a regular basis. They've gone above and beyond to put in mitigation controls inside of the restaurants. They are going to be one of the safer places. And what we've seen
since the restaurants were closed down is a couple
of things.
Yeah, I'm tired of listening to that nonsense. What is new?
I was trying to get to the reporters.
Yeah, I don't care about the reporter. I don't care about any of the reporters in this city because there are no reporters in this city. So just spare me. Number one, you don't meet the criteria. You just said so. You just said so. We meet some, if not all. No, you don't. No. And by the way, that's been the response from the governor's office just in terms of statement of fact. Chicago and Cook County don't qualify. So that's number one. Number two, how long have we known that there's no discernible evidence that transmission is a significant occurrence at restaurants?
The science and data that we have from our contact tracers, which, by the way, is a government job, so they get nice pensions, is that the spread is 1.4 in the city, 1.6, I think, in DuPage County. 1.6%
of the total cases.
I mean, that's such. They shouldn't have been closed in the first place.
Here's why they're closed, and they remain closed, and they remain in the beggar's position, is because this is the response, as reported from the Chicago Restaurant Coalition.
After the mayor's remarks, the Chicago Restaurant Coalition sent a letter to City Hall asking for at least 20% indoor dining occupancy restored by Friday, January 29th. The coalition also said they will take maximum steps to educate restaurant owners about the rules and the penalties for any misconduct.
They're going to educate restaurant owners about these arbitrary edicts from politicians who've destroyed their businesses, who've destroyed these livelihoods.
Yeah.
Oh, and the penalties, too. There's no revolt against that. There's accommodations for it. And by the way, baby steps. And the statements that were made by Lori Lightfoot at that press conference yesterday are treated like Jimmy Chitwood announcing he's going to come back and start playing basketball again. It's ridiculous. So pathetic.
More pathetic. And by the way,
Chicago,
I'm sorry,
and Illinois.
Our positivity rate after yesterday's 9.7%, but that still doesn't meet the metrics. Not even close.
Jason on the north side.
Dan, you asked a very pointed question. What changed recently? Would that be the fact that Biden is going to be president now, which is what we've all predicted? That as soon as Biden becomes president, oh, everything's going to open up again because heaven forbid the economy looks bad under Biden's watch, which only proves that we've said all along if it's about destroying the economy, so it makes Trump look bad so the Democrats can maintain power. And yes, is that part of the thing, too, is to say, oh, well, if we just have people go to the restaurants, we can control what the restaurants will do and or say.
All right, thanks for the call, Jason. That's Noah Rothman, no Trump fan, tweeting out, major metro mayors and governors, I would say, with major metro areas, are on a mission to retroactively validate everything lockdown skeptics have said for months, only to have their motives questioned and characters impugned. Yeah, that's about right. I'll look forward to our apology from Mayor Lightfoot and at some point probably in the not-too-distant future, Governor Jelly Belly, when he does a full reversal as well. Jim in Crown Point.
You know, just let you know, I'm getting a lot of mileage out of your twins joke. It's a hit. Everybody loves it. But going onward, Lori Lightfoot now, restaurants are now the safest place. That was the worst place on the list. How did it jump to number one as the safest?
Right. Thanks for the call. Remember the rhetoric directed at bars and restaurants, too. The shut you down rhetoric. I'm seeing people doing this, and I'm seeing people doing that. I mean, the restaurants, bars, entrepreneurs, they were the enemies.
But then it was so weird then in July, you know, when we hit a 2% positivity rate, 2.9%. They opened up the bars to 1:30 a.m., and I thought, oh, my God, what are they doing? Open up the schools first. Get the teachers back in for summer school, for camps. Don't open the bars to 1:30. That, to me, is, you know, people, you know, they drop their, you know, they lose whatever. They don't follow the rules at 1:30 in the morning because they're drunk and hammered and making out with people at bars. And then the spike went up.
Yeah,
well,
okay. Yeah.
That's what happened. They're not reading books at bars, Dan. I'm sorry. I wish I could tell you that they were. Maybe you read a book at a bar, but... So, you know, I just think they've done this whole thing wrong from the get-go.
Sean in Crown Point.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I need to ask you one question, Dan. I've been listening to your show for a while.
Yeah.
How come you call the governor and mayor names?
Oh, thank you for the question. I love this question. I call the people names, ridicule politicians for the same reason political cartoonists do it, because ridicule reminds both them and us that they are not our betters. And in this time, perhaps more so than in recent memory, that reminder can't be offered enough. How's that?
Well, how come you got bent out of shape when some guy called up and called you a cream puff?
Oh, what?
Called up and called me a cream puff because I was critical of Trump, and so I responded. Lightfoot and Pritzker are welcome to respond to my name calling too if they had the courage to come on this show or in any forum they'd like, Sean. That's how it works.
Oh, okay. I just wondered. That's all.
Sure.
All right. Have a good day, Sean.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks for calling, though.
Love cream that question. Puff. I love that question.
That's your new street name.
Mark and Rochelle.
Hi, I just had a theory. See it running by you. I think that the Democrats have figured out two ways of really controlling people, and that is anger and fear. And the anger was their Trump rhetoric, and the fear was COVID. And they play it like a fiddle, and I think they've really figured it out that that's the way you control people in elections and basically society in a way. What's your thoughts?
I think that's, especially the fear piece of it, I think that's certainly part of it. And I don't know. I think they've done such a good job through all of their cultural institutions over so many generations, turning so much of the population into willing participants in their own subjugation, that all it takes is a little bit of chastising and a little bit of faux moral indignation, and you have entire sectors that are happy to exist only at the convenience of the state. And that's what we're seeing. Jan in Sheboygan.
Hey, Jan.
Hey, boy, Dan, you just said it. That was awesome. You know, political expediency, right? Let's shut down the restaurants. Let's shut down the economy. Let's win the election. As soon as the election's over, let's change it. You know, now that we won, let's try and get the economy back going. Let's bail out the cities with a $2 trillion bailout, bail out the cities and the states that have totally mismanaged everything from New York to New Jersey to Illinois. And let's get the population back to normal, and we'll show them what good governance is, right? Let's stop the riots in the cities because we got what we wanted.
Yep.
And
thanks for the call. Sorry to cut you off. Thanks for the call. Well, you as suggested, Amy, as we've suggested on the show for, I don't know, 10 months, 11 months now.
Yeah.
Schools should not be closed. Problem with that. People like you who want to open the schools are white supremacists, and no less authority than the leadership of the Evanston-Skokie District 65 totalitarian re-education camp has said so.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about Chicago restaurants and this half-hearted call that Lori Lightfoot made to say that it's time we think about talking about reopening restaurants at fractional capacity, and this is being received as some watershed moment, including by the restaurant reps themselves. And I just wanted to say something more about the restaurant reps themselves and the restaurants. You understand that by starting from the premises of these demagogic politicians, that lockdowns were legitimate, that your closure was legitimate, that this slow-walked reopening at fractional capacity is legitimate, you understand something. Their fear they're engendering in the public will negatively impact your business for months and years to come after you're allowed to slowly, gradually, fractionally reopen. You're participating in driving away your own customers because you have so many people that only listen to what politicians say pipe through their comms teams in the media, like Network Affiliate News and the Tribune and the Sun-Times. That's all they know. They're completely fear-addled. So you announcing that you're open at 20% capacity, or even when you're at full at 100% capacity, you won't be at 100% capacity because you have so many people rocking themselves to tranquility in the corner of their room in their homes. So I don't understand why people tolerate lying that takes away their livelihood. And that's what you're doing in Chicago and in other places too, but let's just focus on the local example. I just don't understand it.
Well, outside of Chicago, all the restaurants are open. In fact, I haven't found one that's not open for in-person dining because Pritzker has lost control of his people. And now you've got little Lightfoot begging daddy, please just let us reopen. Come on, big guy. We can do it. And if he folds on that, and as much as I want restaurants to be reopened in Chicago, trust me, I mean, we have family members who have lost jobs because restaurants have closed. But if he's going to bend the rules for her, then why even have rules? I mean, why have rules anyway? He's the only governor in the United States, Dan, whose family doesn't live in the state that he governs. His wife and daughter live in another state. Can't people wake up to that? It's mind-numbing.
There's no rules here because there's no rules in a kleptocracy. And Illinois was a kleptocracy before the pandemic.
Yeah, and now it's even worse.
So you have the rule of men, and this is how it works out. It's all arbitrary, all the time, in every space, with respect to every issue and all aspects of life. What is unclear? I mean, you know, people can choose their own course, and if they want to, live in freedom, they have to go somewhere else. Or freedom, as Kamala Harris apocryphally says. With respect to school reopenings, too, let's take a jaunt out to the suburbs. Evanston Skokie, District 65, one of the great examples in the country of a terrible example of a school district run by the most virulent, ignorant identitarians in the Western world.
Yeah,
and if you think I'm overstating the case, then let me introduce you to
Dr. Devin Horton
and the entire school board.
Horton's African-American.
And he's not a doctor.
No. He's not a doctor. But parents have been voicing their concerns because in schools all around Evanston and Skokie have been reopening, whether full-time or hybrid. So they voiced their concerns, and people that we know got a hold of an email through a FOIA request. And are you ready for this? He wrote back because they want to get back into school, or there's some type of hybrid learning. In the world that we live in, I'm sure that you have not had to reflect on your white supremacist thinking and way of life. White supremacy is no longer the white hooded villain attempting to cause physical harm. You make personal attacks towards me because we're not giving you what you want. I suggest you look in the mirror and reflect on who you are and how you're representing yourself to an African-American leader. I refuse to sit back and be assaulted about my decision-making to not return to in-person learning, especially when the undertone is outright racist. These are white parents asking the black superintendent why their school isn't reopening, and that is his response.
This is public. There was a Zoom call the board had yesterday morning, and among other things that were said by the superintendent, who's not a doctor, here in Evanston Skokie, we're considered to be one of the most woke communities and school districts in the country. That's them describing themselves. Woke is an attribute. It's a feature. Not a bug. We say woke sarcastically.
Yeah.
That's an aspersion. They take it as a compliment. Our approach to creating learning environments that will support closing the achievement gap between Black and Latinx students, a term that Latinos don't recognize. The achievement gap between Black and Latinx students and white students must go deeper. This is why culture is right. He should have said ripe. Culture is right for deep, intense racial equity training. Now we're really going to get serious about racial equity training. And it has been happening, and yet we still have pushback from those who don't believe in our work. And, of course, the pro forma, as a result of our heroism, we're receiving death threats from people who are upset. We're being attacked. People are calling us names. How dare they? How dare they? I want to be clear about our efforts to fight the pandemic of racism that has taken just as many lives as COVID-19. Really? Could you quantify that for us? Could we see the science and data to back that statement? I want to be clear about our efforts to fight the pandemic of racism that has taken just as many lives as COVID-19, writes the collective superintendent and school board of School District 65, Evanston Skokie. Do we have any Evanston Skokie District 65 parents out there? I'd love to hear from them.
312-642-5600, turnkey. Pro answer line again, 312-642-5600.
He goes on, we continue to diversify our workforce, thank God, and we will continue to build an anti-racist curriculum. That means racist curriculum. We will continue to build learning environments where all students can thrive and be their authentic selves. That means where we will train students to work for some George Soros-funded organization upon graduation. The school board president, in the past 6 months alone, we've experienced different, yet in very personal ways, the workings of white supremacy. Tell us about those. Tell us about the workings of white supremacy. Please be specific in all the personal ways that you've experienced them in Evanston and Skokie. Wait a second. I thought that's the most woke school district in America. And that by definition, and it is, Evanston and Skokie are two of the most left communities in America. What's the problem? The problem, she says, is white supremacy being weaponized against our Black leaders and any of us that are committed to prioritizing the needs of Black and brown children. The weaponizing has manifested itself in persistent threatening mischaracterizing messaging. And again, the whole there's death threats. No limits or boundaries to those who are opposed to equity. They lament. Their victims and heroes, and anybody who disagrees with them is not committed to prioritizing the needs of Black and brown children and our white supremacists.
Yeah. If you even ask or try to fight for your kids, if you're white, you're white supremacist.
Mm-hmm.
One parent said that, people are leaving the school district if it's possible for them because they're done with this superintendent, who, again, as you said, is not a doctor.
Five parents, two of whom are pediatricians, last month in December, urged the school board to open schools for in-person learning. They argue that other schools have safely engaged in in-person learning and that it's essential for child social and emotional development. They're pediatricians, at least two of them were. And now we find out, goodness, they're also white supremacists. Right?
I wonder if they knew that they were.
That's why you have a school board. That's why you have a superintendent. You may not know you're a white supremacist. You have to attend a school board meeting and you'll find out.
Who signed up for this?
So I would definitely encourage people to attend a local school board meeting and ask their local superintendent or school board members, particularly if you live in one of these enlightened woke communities with an enlightened woke school district, if you are a white supremacist, so you can begin your repentance just as soon as possible. John on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I hate it for the kids that they're not going to school, but I love it for these elite socialists who are getting cannibalized themselves by their own mad creation of all this white supremacy stuff, and everybody's against each other. We're all just natural, nice human beings. Let's just live together and be happy. You guys have a great weekend and enjoy yourselves.
Thanks, John.
Denny in New Lenox.
Hey, Dan and Amy, how are you guys doing?
Good.
I had a question for Amy. Mm-hmm. What would the schools do if all the parents canceled their internet service And
we've thought about that, like forming a union and going on strike.
We're
talking 400,000.
Yeah, if you want to go back to school, cancel your internet service and then ask the school, how are they going to provide the online education?
All right. I don't know where we could go with that. I mean, there's been talk of it, but we live in Chicago. And they believe, my governor's telling me it's dangerous, or my mayor, that it's got to be dangerous. I'm going to listen to them and not listen to you, Amy.
Well, are they going to pay for your internet service if you guys cancel it? You know, I mean, I know there's people that have lost their jobs, and maybe that's something that they would.
It's not even that. I want them to pay my electric bill, my food bill. Everything's doubled. I mean, honestly, I had no idea how much the school system fed my children.
Fortunately for us, we go back to the hybrid next week, but it's been pretty ridiculous with these kids not being in school.
How old are your kids, Denny?
Our oldest is a freshman in high school, and our four younger ones we sent to the Catholic school because the public school was shut down for so long.
Good for you.
The four younger ones are in school.
Thanks for the call, Denny. Appreciate it. I don't know. What do you think, Denny, white supremacist? He did say it's been a little bit ridiculous. That sounds like white supremacy to me. Lewis in Lewis on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Morning.
Amy, what is that? Okay, Amy,
what?
Hold my beer. Okay, here we go. We getting ready to go win.
Line. Right.
Okay. They confusing me being politically correct with this political correctness. At first they say white supremacists, and then they say white privilege. And now I heard Nancy Pelosi talking about whiteness. You know, that's confusing. And another thing I want to make a comment is about them opening up the bars slowly. Well, they was using, they say that we don't go by the sciences, you know, and follow the sciences. Okay, if they go by the sciences, then we done defeated this virus because we have, two vaccines that's 95 and 94% effective. Okay, so if we got this vaccine, then what is the purpose of the lockdowns?
Right. Thanks for the call, Lewis. Appreciate it.
We're supposed to be in phase five right now. We're supposed to be free because there's a vaccine.
I know, per the standards of the day, that I'm a white supremacist, and what I'm about to say is white supremacy.
Yeah.
Probably be news to this Northwestern University economist as well. But nonetheless, just to reference, since it's moralizing about who's doing the most for minority children. Okay. Northwestern University economist C. Caribou Jackson did an interesting study. This has not been peer-reviewed yet, but it is still worth noting. He studied more than 150,000 ninth graders in Chicago public high schools from 2011 to 2017. He picked Chicago because the school system annually surveys students about their social and emotional skills. Students, for example, report how much effort they believe they put into their schoolwork, how they feel about their relationship with peers, and so forth. All of those answers can be quantified on a scale of 1 to 4, enabling Professor Jackson to calculate how much student social and emotional development improved at each school. And then he combined that into a composite index, somewhat similar to how, you know, SAT scores SAT adds math and verbal test scores. He found that Chicago high schools that ranked high on his three-part index for ninth graders subsequently reduced the number of arrests at school while increasing high school graduation rates and college enrollment rates. Academic, social, emotional skill development, what we talk about all the time. A lot of this is intuitive, but it's still nice to have a study to point to. And this is driving to a point. Students at schools that only produced the highest growth in test scores had less impressive long-term outcomes, so the more holistic assessment. It's still a working paper, but looked at the effective schools versus the less effective schools, and if you moved kids around, what would happen? Students with the weakest eighth grade academic records, most likely to drop out of high school, received larger benefits from attending one of Chicago's most effective schools, while more advantaged students were more likely to attend these higher quality schools in the first place, of course. For example, a disadvantaged student in the bottom 10% would be 3.4 percentage points more likely to graduate from high school, 2.2 percentage points more likely to enroll in college, 2.1% less likely to be arrested by attending a high school in the top 15% of effectiveness compared to an average high school. The researchers also noticed a shift in college behavior. Disadvantaged students were more likely to end up at a two-year community college after attending a more effective high school. Wealthier students were not only more likely to go to college, but also more likely to enroll in a four-year college. Yeah. Imagine. So in a school district where 86-85% of freshmen are qualified for free reduced lunch to come from low-income families, it's basically like 40% black, 40% Latino, and then white and Asian and so forth, smaller percentages. What is this implicitly an endorsement of? Opportunity scholarships, mm-hmm. school choice, competition, 20,000 families on the waiting list to get into a charter school in Chicago. Funding through the tax credit program for opportunity scholarships that provide some kids with a way to get from the average or worse local school in so many neighborhoods to the better school. And the better school has not just results. It's not just about college. In fact, to some extent, it's not even about college. It's developing the entire child academically, socially, emotionally, and moving them away. I mean, it's 2%, 3%, small percentages, but a small percentage of a big population is a big number. Not to mention every child is, worth trying to get on a lifeboat and get out of a bad situation. So if you want to lecture me about helping black and brown kids, then tell me what you would do in the city of Chicago's public school system. And if it's just to send letters about white supremacy, and that's doing so, and teach children all they are is their skin color. Okay, well, that's one path, and a path that's being pointed out by this researcher, this economist from Northwestern University, is another path. And I guess people are going to have to choose their path. Paul in Plainfield.
Hey, so Dan, I've been trying to convince my wife to move for the last 3 years. Longer than that, and she would never want to move, but the school district finally convinced her that it's a good idea to leave the state of Illinois, so we're going to be looking in Texas and Florida this spring and move the following year. We're
good
done.
For you.
Congratulations. Thanks for the call. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Yesterday, we spoke with former head of counterintelligence for the FBI, Frank Figliuzzi, and he said that the possibility of agent provocateurs at and perhaps inciting the assault on the Capitol on January 6th was real. That was a real possibility, despite what Kevin McCarthy said, the House Republican leader, during his comments while speaking to the president's impeachment, that conservatives need to stop talking about Antifa. Well, no, we don't need to stop talking about Antifa, because Antifa continues to riot and engage in violence around the country, base camp Portland, but not limited to Portland. And number two, it's not specifically Antifa with respect to the Capitol. It's open-ended. Well, it seems like with each passing day and more evidence is gathered, it becomes more and more than just a possibility. There's a Black Lives Matter, somebody who's described as a Black Lives Matter and Antifa activist, who filmed his presence at the Capitol assault including from inside the Capitol. And he's his name is John Sullivan on YouTube, as well as over at Gateway Pundit. You can check out his video on Insurgents USA is the name of his, I guess, video series or YouTube channel. And this is in part what he said on camera.
It's all fake. My face is not on Instagram. I learned that shit already. I'm going to wear a Trump hat. I bought one today. I was wearing a Trump hat at the fucking last Trump, at the Trump rally during the daytime. Because I was like, nah. That shit ain't happening, bro. Yeah, I was. Oh, yeah, I was just a journalist. But I use that all the time. Yeah, I'm just a journalist. I'm here recording. I got my camera on my shoulder. Literally have my big camera on my shoulder right here.
Yeah, and it's all a front. If you watch the entirety of the video, he's inside the Capitol. He's cheering on those that are engaged in destructive activities. He's rioting and violence and otherwise. He also filmed the shooting of Ashley Babbitt. He got a side angle of that actual shooting.
And I know who he is because over the summer, John Sullivan was arrested. He organized a violent riot in Utah that ended with a shooting. Nobody died, but there were shots fired. And he was in Utah County Jail for a while. But yeah, he's not a good dude. And he traveled there specifically to make Trump supporters look bad.
To do what he apparently does, which is to incite violence.
Yeah.
And then provide the opportunity for all of the cultural institutions and big media outlets to say those people committing acts of violence represent all 75 million people who voted for Trump, mm-hmm. which is where we're at.
He's evil, but he's crafty.
In addition to that, John Solomon over at justthenews.com talking about some of the recent reporting. We talked about it again yesterday, including with Mr. Figliuzzi. It was incitement. It was planned. And the FBI is looking at conspiracy prosecutions. Well, if it's a conspiracy, that necessarily implicates pre-planning. And this is CNN reporting on this as well. John Solomon giving us some perspective on where we've been before when it comes to the initial reporting and that when we later understand to be true.
We once before were sold the story that there was a spontaneous attack. It occurred in Benghazi.
Right.
Susan Rice, about to go back into the Joe Biden administration, told us it was a spontaneous attack spurred by an anti-Muslim video.
Right.
It was a terror attack carried out by an Al-Qaeda affiliate, planned weeks in advance. That was the final intelligence assessment. The Russia story.
Yes.
Told there was collusion. Then we found out everybody knew there was no collusion and it was a bogus thing, but they went with it anyways. I think this story has the potential to boomerang around in a very different ending than what the American people were presented today.
But the question is, will it matter? The left has what they want. They rush through a drive-through impeachment. Yeah. No investigation.
3 hours.
Nothing.
Length of a movie.
Will it matter at that point?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Another really good question John Solomon raised, and this is why he's an actual journalist, because he actually thinks through these things. Where do we have gaps in knowledge? So you ask the right questions, then you start to do the right investigations and hopefully get some of the correct answers, rather than just taking whatever press release a favored politician issues and regurgitating it, which is what most of the press corps does. What did Pelosi and McConnell know about this?
And the question I have is, what did Nancy Pelosi, what did Mitch McConnell know about these threats beforehand? If they didn't know, it's an intelligence failure of the police. If they did know, there's something they didn't tell us before we went into this impeachment round today.
Right, because if there was pre-planning, then you have federal law enforcement communicating with the sergeant at arms, communicating with the Capitol Police, as the Capitol Police and the sergeant at arms communicate with one another, sergeant at arms for both chambers, and ostensibly then you brief the Senate Majority Leader, the House Speaker. It doesn't seem like it was an intelligence failure, at least from some of the initial reporting about what federal law enforcement knew, the resources that were reportedly offered to Capitol Police that were rebuffed for whatever reason. And so was the knowledge that there was nefarious activity being planned communicated to Capitol Police, communicated to the sergeants at arms, communicated to McConnell and Pelosi. And as Solomon frames it perfectly, either it was and they haven't been forthright, or it wasn't and we have an intelligence failure, and that needs to be part of the post assault reckoning, doesn't it? We don't know the answer to that question, but at least somebody's asking it and investigating to try and find the answer. Owen, with respect to the mob, I feel compelled to participate in correcting the record here. David Quinavalli. David Quinavalli.
Which one's he?
He's a retired Chicago firefighter.
Oh, yes.
He was named on Twitter as the individual who killed the Capitol Hill police officer with the fire extinguisher.
But that wasn't him.
Right. Right. That wasn't him.
Where does he go to get his reputation back, Dan? Did delete the tweet?
After a picture of one man wearing a CFD cap showed up in the pictures in the videos, the mob came after Quinavalli because he bared some resemblance to the picture. And our friend Ed Morrissey reporting on this over at Hot Air as well. And it was posted, and somebody posted, now Twitter, do your thing. And Twitter did a thing. The mob got it wrong. Retired Chicago firefighter from Mount Greenwood was grocery shopping and celebrating his wife's birthday in Chicago. He didn't even know this was happening to him because he's not on social media, because he wants to live a sane life. He didn't know what was going on, and he had no reason to even investigate what was going on until he started getting calls with death threats. Angry calls from people saying he's an effing murderer who belongs in jail. Then TV news reporters were staking out his house. Chicago police dispatched a patrol car to keep watch overnight as well, according to his lawyer. This story has effed up my life, says Quinavalli. His attorney, social media has killed David Quinavalli. Now he has to, I effed up his life. It's probably the more
this too shall
description.
Pass, but still, it just
this too shall
shows
pass.
The volatility and how powerful social media is. Can ruin someone's life and the attribution. I mean, my God, it's see if it was a Chester Fire Department, not Chicago Fire Department, and it was a retired Pennsylvania firefighter. He was arrested. His name's Robert Sanford.
And now,
not our guy.
I know Twitter's not responsible for the content. Right? Parler is, Twitter's not. And so the Twitter, and they're interested in keeping people safe. That's how they curate and moderate content on Twitter, in the interest of keeping people safe. Because what's said online can lead to real world consequences. So that's why we have all these minders to ban Trump's account and the accounts of others, to flag tweets. What about when the mob, including members of the blue check mafia, wrongly accused someone of murdering a police officer? And what's the remedy there? Is that same mob going to tweet with the same fever to correct the record that they tweeted to manufacture a record? What's Jack Dorsey have to say about that? Since they're a force for good, Google's don't be evil, and Twitter's all about public safety. Yeah.
Roles.
Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
all those entities, I really believe, all they are about is about money, power, and influence, and how much they can accumulate to push their agenda. But my original call was concerning the FBI. How many times must we put our faith and into the FBI or any of our intelligence services? I mean, the politicization has crept into almost every institution and destroyed it from within. I mean, everything, church, everything, and it's a real shame. And it's only parents who can grab their kids early enough, the ones that WTTW commentators want to take away and re-educate. It's only parents who teach their kids as they grow up, and these new generations coming up, that's going to change anything. Because the people who are brainwashed and into believing the nonsense with social media and all that garbage, that they're not going to change. I don't think they're going to change. And if Dan, if you're a very, you're the smartest guy I know.
Me too.
I don't know, but listen to. Please tell me what to do. Because I think I'm like 75 million Americans. We go out, pay our taxes. We vote the way we're supposed to vote, and every time we turn around, we're betrayed by the people we vote for eventually. And it just repeats itself on and on and on. Help us. Tell us what to do here.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. I don't have magic answers to this. I'll just repeat what I've said before, which is, start in your household and build out from there. Where you can exercise the most influence, that's in your household.
Right.
That's
take care of your house before you worry about the White House.
That's in your school district. That's in your town, your village, your city. You mentioned church, mm-hmm. the organizations that you're affiliated with civically, professionally. Just be a thought leader and an example within the organizations you already operate and with people you have trust relationships with. That's a good place to start. And stand up for people when you should stand up for them. That was advice Deborah Rowe gave to me a long time ago. Deborah Rowe, former talk show host on WLS. Yeah. We were talking in the context of how can conservatives do a better job of making overtures to Black Americans. And she says one of the things you do is just stand up for people when you should stand up for people. Stand up for Black Americans when there's real injustice. Stand up and be noticed as standing up when somebody's in need. And I think that's true.
That's great
and
advice.
I think it is great advice. And it's going to be visited upon you. All of these things, I've said this all the time with respect to all aspects of this Jacobin culture. We've been saying it for years. As you see university professors taken out, or Brendan Eich separated from Mozilla, the company he founded, because he wrote a $1,500 check to the pro-marriage side of the argument before marriage redefinition in California, and so on. So for all of the examples, one after the other, students being punished for speaking their minds, students being wrongly accused and not being provided due process, this permeating every sector of society, and some people think it's not going to be visited upon my doorstep, and it is. And now it's exponentially worse.
Oh, yeah.
Now they have more power than they've ever had.
And they don't know how to stop. I mean, the House Democrats introduced a bill to ban Trump from the Capitol for life. Macaulay Culkin's wants to erase Trump's cameo in Home Alone 2.
This is so much bigger than Trump. Trump is just easy for them, but they're willing to do and target people who aren't easy under the auspices of Trump, but under the auspices of the self-righteousness that puffs them up to do horrific things. I mean, all of this is sentiment. And if you've taken one theme away from this show, it's that people who are governed solely by sentiment are or will become barbaric. So now you've given them the run of the place. And you think they're going to stop at Trump? Trump is a cudgel, but they're going to use it against you. And this is sort of the point that Laura Logan made. She was on with Laura Ingraham the other night. She made a really good point about the approach that would be taken, including, you know, using deploying these tactics under the guise of the law.
You know, retribution and vengeance is all over social media. It's all over the media itself. It was all over Capitol Hill today. And when they have the power to use the criminal justice system exact retribution, you see they've already, yeah, look out. That's right. They've already laid the groundwork. There's a move to have a new domestic, you know, a new war on terror, but this one, a domestic one, against your own people, looking inwards, and against basically anyone who's a Trump supporter and who's white. And if you've got a gun, if you own a gun, you're on the top of the list.
And then think about what Pritzker did to me here. Didn't like the questions I was asking. Kicked me out of his press conference. Took my media pass away. I don't know what world we're living in anymore. So it's at the national level, at the state level, at your local level, in your school districts, in your neighborhoods. The cancel culture. The you're going to pay.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President-elect Joe Biden on the occasion of unveiling a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package, COVID relief package number 3.0. He had some comment about school reopening, Amy.
Yeah, he did. And is this everybody, every Democratic politician repeats the same stuff? I couldn't believe these words came out of his mouth.
We'll also do everything we can to keep our educators and students safe, to safely reopen a majority of our K through 8 schools by the end of the first 100 days. We can do this if we give the school districts, the schools themselves, the communities, the states.
The reason why my hair is on fire again, what about 9 through 12? What about high schoolers? Does anybody in this country care about them? Are they okay to be on their own? We're just going to take away their lives? And no one's saying anything? It just bothers me.
Well, I think maybe the San Francisco Teachers Union has the answer. The United Educators of San Francisco, an august body, I have no doubt, are demanding the installation of lids on every toilet, which is not required or recommended by county, state, or federal health officials.
What?
We need lids on toilets. Forget HEPA filters. Well, no, forget. In addition to HEPA filters, you know, completely new HVAC systems. A Green New Deal, increasing marginal tax rates on the rich. What are the other demands for teachers to go back to school? Now it's toilet lids.
Okay.
Toilet lids. And it's funny. John Miltimore has a good piece on this over at fee.org. He does recall there were stories when people are trying to figure out how this transmits and the media was doing a wonderful job helping politicians to foment hysteria, suggestions about, flushing toilets. Could that create and so on and so forth? There's a New York Times story about it and so forth. There's just one problem with the call by the San Francisco Teachers Union. The problem is that there has not been, now we're almost a year into this, there has not been a single case worldwide that has been linked to any aerosol residue from flushing a toilet. Not a single case worldwide. If I were a little bit more cynical, I would think, it's almost like they don't want to go back to work. They just want to get paid not to work. But that's the cynic in me. Let's talk to an optimist about this. Maybe he can clear up this toilet matter. Perhaps he had to deal with it with the Chicago Teachers Union. Nothing is beyond the pale these days, is it? Pleased to be joined again by Paul Vallis, the former superintendent of Chicago Public Schools, Philadelphia, New Orleans, former mayoral candidate as well. You know him. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me this morning. The toilet thing, boy, that's just beautiful.
Yeah, you think that could be the inflection point for us to get kids back in schools if we just give the teachers the toilet lids they want?
Maybe that'll be the catalyst. You know, let me point out that this bill also, as you know, the Chicago Public Schools have already received about $1 billion in COVID relief in both the first bill and the second bill. Of course, about $100 million of that had to go to parochial and private schools. But under the Biden bill, they're going to receive, they could potentially receive another $1.6 billion. Now, when you take the private school allocation out, it's about $1.4 billion for a school district that is just now opening and is not opening for high school kids.
Well, what did you think about what Biden said yesterday? I mean, the next 100 days for K through 8, but again, not even including high schoolers. Why are they being ignored on a state and now a national level?
Well, I think clearly the teachers' union is going to dominate the administration. It was it played a big role in the election of Biden, and obviously the selection of the new Secretary of Education was heavily influenced by the union, and I just think it's going to be a union agenda. Plus, if you remember, the platform, the education platform of the Democratic Party was written by the unions, the charter school parents and charter school representatives. And incidentally, charter schools are not-for-profit public schools. So let me just put that on the record. But they were denied any participation. And if you read the Democratic agenda and if you read the NEA, their like proclamation or their manifesto for public education, it really is designed to almost wipe out the remaining public school educational choices that are available to poor parents. And that's why I posted that piece about really the perpetuation of institutional racism in Chicago is really the Chicago Teachers Union, but with their stranglehold over the Chicago public schools.
And speaking of Chicago Teachers Union, this whole issue of teachers not willing to go back and Janice Jackson, the superintendent, saying, well, you're not going to get paid if you don't go back, and then the teachers' union filing labor grievances on behalf of those who aren't getting paid for not going back, and the discussions generically about we're going to pursue the progressive discipline as codified in the union contract. I mean, what is realistic here in terms of what a mayor and a school superintendent and a school board should be doing in terms of getting teachers back to school or else? I mean, what is their stick if the carrot doesn't work?
Look, the union has no leverage. What I would have done is I would have reopened schools in September with the proper safeguards. I would have even deviated from these like bizarre hybrid models, which in some cases don't provide the kids with a better educational service. But the school district is under no obligation to pay teachers, no federal mandates, no state mandates to pay teachers who do not show up for work. And the union really, if they strike, they violate their contract. And I'm sure the union would love to have the $1.5 billion contract that they have that will make them the highest paid teachers and highest paid employees among big city school districts in the nation. I'm sure they'd love to have that contract voided. The problem here is just as they put a very controversial so-called public safety bill on the governor's desk, the police reform bill, which is more a criminals protection bill than it is a bill that's going to help the victims. There's a second bill on the desk stripping the statutes of all those provisions that they enacted in 1995, which would allow the teachers union to strike on just about anything, school closures, class size reduction, staffing models, et cetera. And of course, we'll see if Governor Pritzker signs it, he probably will sign it. So when that legislation passes, the district is really going to have very few options. They're going to have to succumb to the dictates of the union because it literally allows them to strike for just about anything.
Now, in New York, that's the epicenter, death capital of the United States. What is the positivity rate for the schools? Not the city of New York, but inside the schools. What's the positivity rate?
Well, I've seen two rates. First of all, I saw an article just the other day. I think it was in the Wall Street Journal when they talked about the reopening of schools in Miami-Dade. You know, those schools have been open since September. Many, many districts have reopened. In New York, they reopened in September when the city positivity rate rose they closed schools, and the mayor, de Blasio, got so much heat, he quickly reopened them. And the positivity rate, while in the city, was at last, from what I last read, 9%. The positivity rate in the schools, depending on which articles you read, already were from 0.2% to 0.7%. So by all definitions, the absolute safest place to be if you're in New York is in the New York public schools.
But it seems that, and we've talked to Carol Markowitz at the New York Post, she's basically said, with respect to the spring, she's sort of conceded that they're not going to be back in school in any meaningful way this spring. I'm hoping for the fall. Is that what parents in Chicago and Illinois should be hoping for, is something approximating a resumption of the normal school day by the fall?
Yeah, I think so. I think the best you can hope for is that the school day will be restored, hopefully, in the fall. I certainly think there's going to be even the Chicago Public School plan does not open high schools. There's no date for opening high schools. And let me point out that in Chicago alone, and I read an article just the other day that was, I think there was a shooting, Bridgeport carjacking, 15-year-old. There was another carjacking by another 15-year-old, one in Bridgeport. The other one, I think it was in Lincoln Park.
Yes.
And the police have told me that a minimum 25%, and probably far greater, of the carjackings have been done by teenagers.
Yep.
The firefighter who was shot in Beverly, retired firefighter, was shot by a teenager. But there have been 83 school-aged children in Chicago murdered this year and 567 shot, because every day 100,000 high school kids are either at home, most probably alone, or they're walking the dangerous streets of Chicago. So reason alone would be a reason to get these kids back in school.
All they have to do is turn on the camera, and then they can leave for the whole day, and the teachers not know, then come back at 3 o'clock and click off, and that's considered present. It's not absent.
Yeah.
They know how to work the system. Trust me, and if you're not there they'll do whatever they want to do.
And Amy, I'm not suggesting that there aren't teachers that are dissenting. I'm not suggesting that the majority of teachers aren't working really, really hard. As you know, I think you met a couple from Hawaii who were mailing it in. And of course, we have the much celebrated case of the union official in Florida sending us wonderful pictures of her pool party.
Yeah, Sarah Chambers. And whatever happened to her?
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously the media didn't spend a lot of time because that is contrary to the narrative. But you have to understand, real, real damage is being done to children, social, emotionally, academically. All the pediatricians and the child experts tell you the damage that is done, particularly for the youngest kids. They shouldn't be on a computer or for more than an hour. Real damage is being done during a period of accelerated brain development, and that damage is permanent. That is not temporary damage, that is permanent damage. And then, of course, on the back end with the high school kids, I mean, how many borderline high school children in Chicago? And high school kids are being hurt all over the country, in affluent districts where the high schools, you know, obviously are the center of so many students' world, or for that matter, even in the city of Chicago. But these poor kids walking the street on the street, the gangs aren't taking a holiday. The gangs aren't conforming to Governor Pritzker's,
stay-at-home
COVID. Protections, you know. I mean, they're open for business, and they're recruiting these kids, and these kids are getting shot, and they're participating in the carjackings. It's just a dangerous situation, but the union doesn't care, period.
And the other thing they're doing is taking advantage of just the focus on reopening schools, or such understandable emphasis on that, and not on what the curriculum is going to be when the schools do reopen. And I'm speaking to things like the culturally responsive teaching and learning standards rule that the Illinois State Board of Education has proposed, that would further politicize the classrooms and focus on trying to raise these kids to be, or teach these kids to be, political activists rather than well-rounded students who are going to go on to college and beyond.
Well, you know, Dan, you can rest assured that accountability is out the window. that the type of aggressive accountability that three prior presidential administrations have been pushing is now going to be set aside. I mean, look, the teachers union, even when they forced the district to go full remote, didn't want a full day of remote instruction. They wanted to limit it to 3 hours. And then, of course, they didn't want their remote instruction to be observed. And so it's a disaster.
He is Paul Vallis, former superintendent of Chicago Public Schools, former mayoral candidate. Paul, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Have a great morning.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez taking to Instagram or one of those online platforms.
Oh,
where
she's a grammar. It's all about the gram.
She doesn't get censored. Mm-hmm. Talking about the need for media literacy and even invoking a favorite phrase of the left, Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
I do think that several members of Congress in some of my discussions have brought up media literacy because that is a part of what happened here. And we're going to have to figure out how we rein in our media environment so that you can't just spew disinformation and misinformation. It's one thing to have differing opinions, but it's another thing entirely to just say things that are false. And so that's something that we're looking into.
Hmm. She's going to be the arbiter of what's true. She and her squad members, the arbiter of what's true. That functionally should be interesting.
The right doesn't have a voice right now. What is she talking about?
Joy Reid over at MSNBC called for the debathification of the Republican Party.
Oh.
That's an interesting invocation. Tom Nichols, who is a member of the USA Board of Contributors, USA Today Board of Contributors, and an advisor to the Lincoln Project, the home of some of the most angry individuals and vile rhetoric that is available in the public arena at present. Tom Nichols writes, the president's supporters now plead for understanding and inclusion, for lowering the temperature, for moving on. This is moral charlatanism, and I say to hell with it. It's almost impossible to comprehend the sheer moral poverty of the people calling now for unity. I mean, except Joe Biden, I guess, for Tom Nichols. Elected Republicans now admit they fear for their physical safety from their own constituents, but instead of thunderous defenses of the Constitution, we have soft mewling from people like Marco Rubio and his Bible verse a day tweets, or the head spinning duplicity of Senator Lindsey Graham. There's no unity available. There's no inclusion or understanding available for Trump voters, Trump supporters, until and unless they make amends for what they did by supporting Trump.
Well, at Harvard University, students are circulating a petition that calls for revoking degrees, Dan, from Trump supporters and aides who attended that elite institution, whatever. But the reason they said, according to a copy of the petition, that supporters of President Trump were involved in spreading disinformation and mistrust that led to last week's deadly riot.
For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined again by Brett Baer, Fox News anchor, host of Special Report, 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, Chicago, 5 p.m. Chicago time, of course, and also the author of 3 Days at the Brink, FDR's Daring Gamble to Win World War II. That's a bestseller. Brett, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Media Literacy Commission to make sure you're not saying anything that is factually incorrect. Government Commission. Debathification of the Republican Party. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think it's going down a really bad road.
And I think people realize that, but we have to talk about it and point a spotlight at it. Some of the things being said over the past few days are really startling. When a TV host in a primetime show says that the 74-plus million people that voted for Donald Trump are on the side of the Klan, mm-hmm. are on the side of xenophobia, are on the side of, you know, violence, that's really something. I hate the whole thing of the hypocrisy of look at what the left did or didn't say when the BLM and the riots around the George Floyd stuff. I mean, I hate it just because it's true, but it's you know, that's the argument. But I think it's more clear cut. I mean, now is a moment where clearly last Wednesday changed the dynamic and the Trump power base changed. But instead of absorbing that and moving on as a country and kind of trying to get out after that, the critics of the president are going for the full-on chop the head off the snake, let's put this behind us, to make the people who supported Donald Trump feel like they're somehow lesser because they did, because of last Wednesday and the actions of the rioters. I think that that's misplaced and actually dangerous to the other way. Could fire people up to, do something else. And I just think it's not a smart way to approach it.
Well, I think, that's sort of what Andy Biggs, representative from Arizona, said yesterday during the impeachment debate, or Wednesday during the impeachment debate, where he said, you know, what you're doing is you're making a martyr of President Trump. And, oh, by the way, as more information comes out about just exactly what went down and who the responsible parties are with respect to the assault on the Capitol. And yes, there were certainly Trump supporters in the Capitol, but you had an arrest of a Black Lives Matter Antifa activist, John Sullivan, by the FBI. You've got stories now all over the place about information that federal law enforcement had in terms of pre-planning. You've got the FBI talking about charging a conspiracy case. They're talking about a conspiracy case that necessarily implicates pre-planning. So that's only going to further enrage the caricature of what happened on January 6th as representative. The people who are reject the caricature of what happened on January 6th as representative of 75 million people who voted for Trump.
Yeah, I would be careful about characterizing, you know, the people who have been arrested. There was the one guy, John Sullivan, who told authorities when he was arrested that he was documenting it. Whatever. We can look into that case, right? But for the most part, of the dozens and dozens of people arrested, they are tied to QAnon and far-right militant or militia groups. And so that's going to be a problem. We have to look just case by case who was in there, who instigated it, and why.
Right.
But to paint with a broad brush, for anybody to say that all 75 million Trump supporters have the blood of that police officer on their hand because they voted the way they voted is such a sweeping kind of statement. It's sad. The best thing that we can do is take the temperature down and report on facts.
Well, here's the thing. So do you think it's in President Trump and our country's best interest for him to skip the inauguration? I mean, KT McFarland was on the show, and she said, how we're going to unify this country, we need Biden and Trump to get together.
Yeah. I'm not advising him. I'm covering him. But I would have gone to the inauguration no matter what. I mean, I would have said, if I'm really behind a peaceful transfer of power, right, there should be a visual of that transfer of power. But he's choosing not to.
And so, Brett, how is this going to work? Because the inauguration is going to happen, and then 2 hours later, they're going to begin the impeachment trial against President Trump. I mean, that's on all that on the same day.
Yeah, this is the weird part about this, is that so the president leaves office, and then this trial starts in the Senate. And, you know, I'm just wondering whether Biden is going to say, listen, Chuck Schumer, I know you have your marching orders, but we need to get this agenda through. And yes, you can walk and chew gum, but maybe we should not focus on the trial. And I don't know if that's going to happen or not. Maybe it will.
I think it's going to be very difficult for Biden to pull them back from the brink. And by the way, that's just not who Biden is. I mean, Biden is, you know, he's a guy who goes where the wind blows. So, what you know, we'll see. One of the other things, though, too, I mean, there's real disagreement about whether it is constitutional for the Senate to hold an impeachment trial after the president has left office. And I wonder if that gets litigated and provides some interruption to that trial.
Well, clearly the way it was voted in the House, there were not committee hearings, there was not testimony, there was not, you know, both sides. That's usually the grand jury. The House is the grand jury, and then the trial itself is in the Senate. Either way they do it, it doesn't appear like it's set up to be a full-blown trial. And nor do I think the country at that point, once Trump has left, is in any mode to sit there and wade through exactly what was said and relitigate that speech on the National Mall. We'll see what happens. I think there's a chance that something changes between now and January 20th.
One question that John Solomon has raised, John Solomon from justthenews.com has raised, I think is a good one, is was it an intelligence failure, or are Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi not telling us something about what was known and should have been known pre-assault on the Capitol, meaning that if federal law enforcement had an idea, like they do in advance of the inauguration through chatter and the monitoring they do, that something nefarious was afoot, then either that was communicated to Capitol Police, to the Sergeant-at-Arms of the two chambers, or it wasn't. If it wasn't, then it's a communication failure. If it was, then Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell haven't been forthright about it.
I still think there's a lot we don't know. And, we every day seem to get more information on the severity of it. But as far as what was known and exactly what they did about that, I think there's a lot that we don't know. As far as why was the security presence the way it was? Why wasn't it where it was for some of the other marches? Why, the head of security, the son of the sergeant of arms, commits suicide? There's just a lot that we don't know. And I do know that watching these videos, the police officers who were there performed valiantly to prevent, first of all, the senators and congressmen and women to get to safety.
Before we let you go, I know there was a charity event you wanted to mention, so please mention that.
Oh, yeah. So we do this event every year in Naples, but now because we had to do virtual, it's going to be open for everybody. And it's really great. I've got Brian Kilmeade and Charles Payne, Shannon Bream, Emily Campagno, and me. We'll do a panel discussion with the viewers' questions, all people's questions who get tickets. And we've got performances and then an auction. All goes raise money for Children's National, which saved my son's life now four times. And it's allstarpanelevent.com, allstarpanelevent.com. And you get tickets, and it's a virtual event. But the biggest thing is that there are all kinds of auction items, like Zoom calls with talent or stars, or somebody could do your phone message, recording, and whatever. We're going to raise a lot of money. We're going to do it virtual, and we'll be live again next year.
That's great. The website again, allstarpanels.com.
Allstarpanelevent.com.
Allstarpanelevent.com. Okay, allstarpanelevent.com, allstarpanelevent.com.
I'll repeat it.
Brett Baer, host of Fox News Special Report, 5 p.m. weekdays, Chicago time. Also, author of the number one bestseller, 3 Days at the Brink. Brett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Okay, see you guys.
Thanks, and good luck with your fundraiser. Allstarpanelevent.com. And Brett Baer joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and there has finally been some fallout from the great Bobby Rush popcorn caper from last summer amid the rioting that was going on in Chicago.
Yeah, I remember the video. I'm sure everybody saw it. It caught, you know, 17 police officers were lying on congressman's couch, resting their heads on his desk, helping themselves to coffee and popcorn, Dan. Popcorn without his knowledge. He was really upset about the popcorn.
They even had the unmitigated gall to go and make coffee for themselves and to pop popcorn, my popcorn, in my microwave.
Is that really your popcorn or is it the people's popcorn, Congressman Rush?
I don't know if you're watching in line and online in our Matrix Home Solutions studio. You can see we still have Bobby Rush's popcorn right here in the studio.
I know there were suspensions handed out that are being appealed by the Fraternal Order of Police, but my question, the big question, I think this is the law enforcement question that has bedeviled the city for the better part of a year now, is has Bobby Rush's stock of Orville Redenbacher been replenished?
I mean, it's an 89-cent bag of popcorn. And the reason why they were there, because we had police officers call in, and the reason why they were there, they were exhausted. They had worked around the clock. It was hot outside, and they didn't have vans or anything to sit in, and they were told to respond. No, they said that they were responding to someone's call from Bobby Rush's office that said check on the place.
Yes.
So they checked on the place.
They responded to a call from his office because the mall was being ransacked. The mall in which his office is located was being ransacked. That's why.
Yeah, and there's 17 officers that are going to be suspended from 1 day to 20 days. We don't know who ate the popcorn, and frankly, I don't care. And if anybody ever reveals that officer's name.
I do. I will not rest until the Chicago police officer who ate Bobby Rush's popcorn is brought to justice.
Bobby Rush said yesterday, I'm not running a victory lap because of this. At the end of the day, we want a better, more equitable, more responsive police force.
Well, what we want in Chicago is for everybody's popcorn to be protected.
Exactly.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Project Veritas at it again. James O'Keefe and his investigative reporters getting all sorts of information from big tech, including some statements from that Garden Gnome CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey. Jack Dorsey saying the following about what Twitter has planned. It's much bigger than just deplatforming President Trump.
Just to close out a little bit, we are focused on one account right now, but this is going to be much bigger than just one account, and it's going to go on for much longer than just this day, this week, the next few weeks. It's going to go on beyond the inauguration. We have to expect that. We have to be ready for that. So the focus is certainly on this account and how it ties to real-world violence, but also we need to think much longer term around how these dynamics play out over time. I don't believe this is going away anytime soon. And the moves that we're making today around QAnon, for instance, is one such example of a much broader approach that we should be looking at and going deeper on. So the team has a lot of work and a lot of focus on this particular issue. But we also need to give them the space and the support to focus on the much bigger picture. Because it is not going away. The U.S. is extremely divided. Our platform is showing that every single day. And our role is to protect the integrity of that conversation and do what we can to make sure that no one is being harmed based off that. And that is the focus, and that is the color we're going to provide.
Couldn't you just listen to him talk all day? Isn't he just so enjoyable?
Uh-huh.
For more on this, pleased to be joined by Terry Schilling. He's the executive director of the American Principles Project. The American Principles Project has launched a petition in support of regulating big tech. Terry, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dan. Always love coming on.
So your reaction to, Jack Dorsey's statements there that Project Veritas was able to obtain, as well as his tweets the other day talking about how it was a difficult decision to ban Trump. It was he feels like it was a failure, but it was also the right decision, and he's working with other people to chart a course going forward. And now you heard from him in his own words what that forward-looking course may be as it pertains to more restrictions on his platform.
Yeah, so I think at the heart of where Twitter has gone wrong and where Silicon Valley and the big tech world has gone wrong is there's an inherent anti-Americanism. And I don't mean that in, like, they don't like America or they don't, you know, they want America to fail. What I mean is they reject the founding principles of America, in that, you know, our founders believed in the people and they had an optimism in everyday people to be able to handle things. That's why they gave us the right to vote. And these Silicon Valley techs, they reject that. They don't even trust us to be able to handle information they don't want us to have, right? Like they want to censor us. They want to shut down. You know, they think that if you listen to Donald Trump talk about voter fraud and lack of integrity at the ballot box, you're going to go blow up the Capitol building. That's actually what they're arguing now. And so they have to save us from that. And I think that that's ultimately going to be their demise. And unfortunately, we're going to have to rebuild everything after that. If they allow us to, I mean, there's real concern that the monopoly is so deep that, you know, you saw what happened with Parler. Parler was the build your own solution to Twitter censorship, and they ended up shutting them down through their servers, through Amazon.
I suppose one of the lessons from Parler, though, too, is from the Parler example is, you know, you shouldn't rely on your enemies to provide support for your project. And, you know, frankly, Amazon Web Services is not going to be an ally of people who believe in free speech as imagined by the founders.
No, that's exactly right. And the thing that's been glaringly, you know, obvious now is that we do have to rebuild everything. And you know, building a whole server platform, very difficult, and it takes a lot of resources. But we've been asleep at the wheel. We've been convincing ourselves that these corporations just want to make money. Well, they don't just want to make money. They have a lot more interest in controlling people than we thought.
Well, eventually President Trump is going to get his voice back on some platform. How is it going to happen? What do you see in the future? Because they can't silence him forever, right?
Exactly. And the thing is that maybe you don't want to silence him because of what comes next. You know, I mean, if you shut down Trump, there's going to be some leader that rises up to address the concerns of these people. Trump, what people don't seem to realize, at least in Silicon Valley, is that Trump is a symptom of what's happening in this country. He's representing millions of Americans who feel left behind. And people have actually done the study of this, and they suggest that it's the Ross Perot vote. Of those working class people who feel like the elites, the business elites in the Republican Party and the government elites in the Democratic Party don't care about them. And that movement, as we've seen, has only grown, and it got 75 million votes last election. So, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about what Trump's going to do after this. He could start his own, you know, online platform like Twitter alternative, or he could start his own news network. We'll see, but the guy's definitely not going away.
The bigger problem is the premise, right, with respect to the standards that are being set. And this shouldn't be surprising from the social media platforms, because there's the same standard that has long ago been set on college campuses and then in corporate boardrooms. And they have much more cultural influence than does the government. And the standard is this: with respect to expression, if the consumer or the person listening is offended, if feels threatened, feels unsafe, then you should be censored. So everything is ear or eye of the beholder, no matter how unreasonable. And so it's very simple to silence your opponents, and the left figured this out a long time ago. You just characterize speech as hate speech. You characterize the speaker as a violent extremist. And then what you're doing in censoring them isn't censoring them. You're providing for the public safety. And that's exactly the explanation that Twitter provided in banning Trump.
No, that's exactly right, Dan. And the thing is, we all kind of poo-pooed the college stuff, you know, with them indoctrinating the kids. Is we said, oh, well, they're Marxist now and they're crazy now, but wait till they get to the real world. Wait till they get, you know, a real job and they have to survive there. Then they'll change. Well, now they've taken over the real world and they haven't changed. And they're setting the standards and the values of all these companies that they're enforcing on the American people. And it's really, really scary.
Yeah. And here's the thing. I'm not worried about Trump being silenced. He's not going to be silenced. The left really doesn't want him silenced. Thus, the impeachment unites Democrats, divides Republicans. They're trying to keep him around as a whipping boy as long as they can. I'm worried about smart people being silenced. I'm worried about regular people being silenced and marginalized and pushed out of the political arena, and maybe pushed out of professional callings, too, and what that portends for this country in terms of peace and pluralism. Because if that's what you're doing, you're not going to have either peace or pluralism.
No, that's exactly right. And it really is what's at the heart of this country is they wanted the power to be put in the hands of the people, and they wanted, you know, they wanted a million experiments going at once. They wanted information to flow from the bottom up, not leaders telling us what to do from the top down. And we need to get back to that. We need to get back to the free expression of ideas and experiments. And even with this COVID stuff, I mean, we've had a great silencing of alternative ideas. And it's at the same root is this belief that the people are dumb. They can't be trusted to decipher good information versus bad information. And we just need to realize, you know, the elites can be just as wrong and just as bad as the people can be. So we just need to trust people to make the right decisions and give them as much information as possible.
Here's some rather disturbing data. Scott Rasmussen polling finds 25% of those surveyed on the question of whether or not we should divide America into red states and blue states, formally divide America. 25% support dividing America into red states and blue states. Interestingly, regular churchgoers more likely to favor a red America and a blue America. 40% of those who attend church more than once a week support the move.
You know, I think that that's rooted in this fear that we have now. And what I think the fear is this, you know, the Democrats' rhetoric has gotten so extreme. I mean, look, I don't support what happened at the Capitol by any means. But, like, they're talking about Trump supporters and they're referring to them as terrorists. You had that PBS executive talk about, you know, how after Biden wins, we're coming after the children of Trump supporters and we're going to put them in re-education camps. I think there's a real fear among the base conservative voters. They think that the Democrats are coming for them. And in a lot of ways, they have been coming for them for a while, right? You know, when the PBS executive's words came out about the re-education camps, it's like, well, you know, I guess you'd have to have some other type of re-education camps now that the schools are all shut down and the universities are mostly closed. But I don't know. I think there's a real fear that people now want to shrink back and just protect what they have and make sure that their families are protected from any type of government overreach. I think that's the root of what you were seeing in that poll.
Terry, we had a realtor here. She worked at App Properties in Chicago. She went to the Trump rally in D.C. She didn't storm the Capitol. She didn't go in. She didn't get arrested. And she got fired because she attended the rally. That's some scary stuff.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's nuts. And like, are we not free to have our own beliefs about the election not being conducted in a fair way? I mean, this was an extraordinary election conducted with mass mail-in balloting in all of the key swing states. And we've never done that before in those states. I mean, I think it's fair to say that, you know, there was probably some ballot harvesting. There was probably some fake signatures on these ballots. You know, there's questions that we need to answer. And at the heart, like at the heart of this country is fair and free elections and the consent of the governed. And I don't know, it's really terrible. And it's scary that someone can get fired or, you know, now they're talking about losing your job based on your political views. It's crazy.
He is Terry Schilling, Executive Director of the American Principles Project. Terry, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Dan. Thanks, guys.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, and something else, John Solomon over at Just the News said, we talked a bit about him with Brett Baer, about the forthcoming, perhaps forthcoming, I never want to assume these things, release of declassification, release of documents related to the Russian collusion investigation.
Yeah.
Take a listen.
Hillary Clinton's team invented the Russia collusion story and used intelligence apparatchiks to get it into the system after learning that she had new problems on her email, that maybe a foreign power had possession of some of her classified emails. And they went out to, this is a document I've seen, vilify Donald Trump with this false story. That's, I think, what these documents will put into a time continuum, help people to understand a more 30,000-foot view of what really happened. Now, today, as I was working on this, I learned of another document that was kept from the president's impeachment team, I'm told, was kept from the Senate investigators. They only recently learned about it.
Yes.
What is it? It is an email on November 22nd, 2016, by George Kent, the guy with the bow tie, the Democrat star witness in the first impeachment trial where they at least allowed some witnesses.
Yes.
And he wrote in November 22nd about his concerns about Joe Biden in the context of Burisma and Hunter Biden, the conflict of interest. We know he's testified he saw the appearance of a conflict of interest.
Yes.
He tried to warn Joe Biden that maybe he shouldn't be involved in this, and he couldn't get to the vice president. This is a contemporaneous document where he mentions the vice president in this context. It was classified. Everybody who's looked at it tells me there's no national security information. The only thing this is protecting is not security information. It's protecting reputations. So I'm hoping that in the next 24, 48 hours, the State Department will finally make this document public. But keep in mind, we went through an impeachment, and this sort of critical evidence was not released.
Yeah, John Solomon may be more optimistic than I am because I'm still waiting for the Durham investigation to be completed.
Yeah, don't hold your breath.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So some of the first legislation to be filed in this new edition of Congress. D.C. statehood, of course, that's a favorite. Also, as it pertains to elections, though, Nancy Pelosi and House Democrat Socialists want to impose California state-style election rules nationwide. Legislation would require every state to register voters based on names in state and federal databases, any such as anyone receiving food stamps or who interacts with a state DMV, mandates same-day and online voter registration, expands mail and early voting, expands mail and early voting.
Year-long voting now?
Start now. Start voting in November for your midterm elections.
Yeah.
Limit states' ability to remove voter rolls, to remove voters from the rolls, that is.
Why would you want that? I mean, you have to clean your voter rolls.
Why would you want that?
Oh, yeah, you're right. To remove dead people.
Also, campaign finance provisions that would target the political speech of conservatives. Require some nonprofits to disclose publicly the names of donors who give more than $10,000. Even if those groups aren't taking part in candidate elections. This is a way to, you know, use their allies in the purge to target the donor class for conservatives and Republicans as well.
Purging's not enough. Now you have to intimidate. Okay, this is good. Yeah.
And with respect to the administration of elections, you know, I'm not even sure anymore if the even if the election rules, the laws were changed or they were guarded in places like Pennsylvania, it would matter. And I point to this story of the final state race in Pennsylvania being decided, a state Senate race in Allegheny County. The at issue between the Democrat incumbent state senator and the Republican challenger were 300 absentee ballots in Allegheny County that voters neglected to date. If the undated ballots were counted, the Democrat would win. If the undated ballots were not counted, the Republican would win. And the law is voters must date and sign the absentee ballot application in order for it to be counted. But that's not what a judge ruled, and a higher court declined to essentially take up the case. And so the Democrat incumbent wins because ballots were counted that run afoul of the black letter of the law. So reluctant are courts to overturn the stated election results, leaving that to local election authorities. So if local election authorities say it's okay to break the rules, to break the law, then it's okay to break the law and you're not going to have courts intercede. Well, then how can we even have a conversation if that's going to be the culture at the state level in places like Pennsylvania, important states, swing states? And then we'll see what happens at the federal level with the air support that Nancy Pelosi and Democrat socialists are trying to provide. Then is it even worth having a discussion about, at the state legislative level, that's where we need to make sure that you don't have administrative agencies or courts usurping the authority of the state legislatures. I guess state legislatures don't matter and state laws don't matter if they're Republican controlled or inspired. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Paul Kanger, who is a political science professor at Grove City College in Pennsylvania. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Amy, good to be back.
What about the state you call home and the substantive case there, forgetting all the different accusations about voter fraud, just the unwillingness to enforce the letter of the state election law in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, well, I'm about 55 miles north of Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh's in Allegheny County. That's the county you were talking about. I was born there and went to school there, University of Pittsburgh. And so this isn't a surprise. I've been watching this carefully. And, yeah, you're right, Dan. So you got 300 votes, and it's a matter of whether or not they're dated or not. And it's, you know, typically you would take this to the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, which is 5 elected Democrats versus 2 elected Republicans. And it was the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court that blew everything up here to begin with. You know, they're the ones who, going outside of their constitutional authority in the state of Pennsylvania, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, they changed election law, which to allow mail-in ballots, to change the dates, and when the mail-in ballots were allowed to come in, they are not allowed to do that. That's the province of the state legislature. But they went ahead and did it anyway. And then after the election, when all of this was challenged in the state of Pennsylvania by people like Pennsylvania State Senator Doug Mastriano, Mike Kelly, who's actually my congressman from the Mercer County, Pennsylvania area, the state Supreme Court laughed at them and said, you're late. And they cited this thing called latches, right? Mm-hmm. Latches, right? And so it's fascinating. This applies to exactly what you just read to listeners. They intervene or intercede when it's to their benefit, and then they don't intervene or intercede when it's to their benefit. So in this case, they're, I guess, going to not intercede, and then that way these ballots without dates on them can be counted, and that way their guy can win. And liberals turn around and they accuse Republicans and Trump supporters and everybody else of being the political ones, right? But these 5 Democrats on the state Supreme Court, it's just a nightmare. And I don't know. I was on Mark Levin's show over the weekend, and Mark Levin asked me on the TV show. He said, "What can be done about this?" And I said, "I honestly don't know. I mean, what can the state legislature do to rein in kind of renegade activist judges? And I'm asking you this as well, Dan, because how could an activist judge just go and do something and then just kind of get away with it? It'd be like if the Chicago Bulls were playing, and all of a sudden, you know, three guys just come on the court in the fourth quarter for the other team, and now it's 8-5, and a couple of the refs just kind of let them get away with it, right? And everybody in the audience is yelling and saying, you're not allowed to do this, but they do it anyway. And then everyone's like, well, who can stop them? They're like, I don't know who can stop them, right? And so they do, and then they run up, you know, another 20 points against the Bulls, and then the game's over. It's just a crazy, maddening thing. And you know, this is this happened in Pennsylvania, and you know, quite possibly in the other states as well. It's just it's so frustrating.
Hmm. Interesting resignation letter or retirement letter. Speaking of academia, since you're a member, from John Eastman, who was a law professor and dean at Chapman University's Fowler School of Law.
I saw that today.
He, as you know, he committed the sin of being a counselor advisor to the president of the United States. That would be Trump. And he also
compounded. It is a sin.
I understand. And he compounded that by articulating legal arguments like the one, and having legal conversations rooted in the law like the one we're having about Pennsylvania. And there was a move afoot among the professorate, mostly the undergrad professorate, to have him drummed out. And he basically says, you know, it's not worth it for me. I'm retiring in the face of this sort of anti-intellectual mob mentality on campus.
Right, right. And the professor was a poli-sci professor. And he and Eastman points out in this really beautifully written letter that it wasn't law school professors who challenged him. It was these basically activist liberal poli-sci professors. And the letter, this is ironic. You asked me about this. I was just reading this morning, and I immediately sent it to probably about a dozen different judges and law school types that I know around the country. And he not only does he talk about the persecution here, but with Pennsylvania, and I told people in my email, I said, read this letter simply if you want a good two or three paragraph summation on what happened constitutionally that people like Trump's lawyers and Ted Cruz are pointing out. And he writes here in Pennsylvania, the partisan elected judiciary in the conduct of Pennsylvania's election, they usurped the sole power of the legislature. The PA election results couldn't be certified. Well, I won't go through and I won't read it, but it's a lot of what he just said. And what's interesting about this, one of the people who emailed this to me this morning, in fact, a fellow academic, that's how I got it first. She said to me, she said, you know, I really wish that Eastman here would stay and fight. But on the other hand, you can't blame the guy for just saying enough is enough. I don't want to be in this to borrow from a liberal phrase that applies here. I don't want to be part of this hostile work environment, right, where I just get harassed all the time. And if you're going to turn your college over to leftists and, you know, let the leftists run the asylum, you know, I'm going to go somewhere else. You know, why do I have to spend the last 5-10 years of my professional career in misery? And he points out here at the end of this article, where is he going? I think I'm currently on leave from Chapman while serving as the visiting professor of conservative thought at the Benson Center for the Study of Western Civilization at the University of Colorado Boulder. And I think he says that, Dan, between that and a Claremont position, he's going there, right?
Right.
I'm going to go there instead, and who could blame them? And so liberals are creating an environment where conservatives are going to go to exclusively conservative schools where they won't be harassed, and then liberals will have their exclusively liberal schools where liberals can have complete control of their kind of intellectual fiefdoms, and then they'll be all satisfied. They can say that they're victorious after they've completely segregated the country into kind of, intellectual areas where just conservatives and just liberals. And then, of course, that won't be enough for the liberals. Then, like conservative churches, they'll have to go after these places.
That's right.
To try to shut them down, too. They won't be happy with what they've created.
Well, that's right. So that the problem is, some people like Eastman have the luxury of finding a soft landing spot. A lot of people don't. And as soon as you have that, to some extent, you have more of that stratification by ideology or political philosophy. Well, you're far overwhelmed in these institutions by the left, starting in academia, and they will come for whatever you think is a safe haven. So going back to your overarching question, how do you address this when the courts decide they're not going to interpret the law? How do you address it when the legislature decides they're not going to make the law? How do you address it when the executive says he's not going to execute the law? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows, but I think we know where it goes.
Yeah, and in fact, Levin asked me that question on Sunday, and I said, if you're looking for a kind of practical solution, I would say one thing would be that the Republican National Committee should hold like a big seminar or conference, right? It may be the summer where they invite Pennsylvania or where they invite Republican legislators from all around the country and bring in legal people and have kind of brainstorming sessions. What can we do to kind of stop this kind of thing in the future? I mean, they're literally going to have to hold like seminars to figure out what do we do when something like this happens? How do you stop this? And by the way, on the Eastman thing, let me say this too, Dan, that this case involves the election, the November election, with Eastman representing Donald Trump and so forth. But this kind of hostile environment, I mean, this is already hitting hyperspeed in the academy on matters of race and LGBTQ. And I mean, that's where it's going to be really bad. I wrote a piece for American Spectator. It's posted there right now, January 6, 2021, the new Kristallnacht, right? The new Pearl Harbor, the new 9/11. And I quote this professor from University of Texas at Austin, and he's listed in this article in Inside Higher Ed as a, quote, scholar of democracy, unquote. And he says the event of the Capitol is another 9/11 attack on the U.S. government by terrorists. Now, that's an exact quote. Quote, the attackers are motivated by xenophobia, racism, and hate, unquote. And then that not being enough, Dan, right, he takes this from the attackers of the insurrection at the Capitol, and puts them aside, puts Donald Trump aside, and then goes after the entire GOP leadership. By the way, this would include Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, presumably. Quote, today's terrorism is at the heart of the Republican Party, which now, in much of its leadership, has become a white supremacist Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. That guy sounds like a speechwriter for the House and Senate Democrat Socialist caucuses.
Well, he has an endowed chair at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's calling the entire quote, much of the Republican leadership, unquote, has become a white supremacist Al-Qaeda. So for people thinking, like some of the people emailing me now, kind of David French types and others, that after they've gotten Donald Trump run out of office, it's going to cool now, and at least they won't be calling Republicans white supremacists anymore. Oh, no. Mm-hmm. No. This has just begun. This is, and it's not just people who voted for Donald Trump. If you've got an R next to your name, right, and believe me, they're going after Ronald Reagan retroactively. They went after I can give you quotes from Maxine Waters calling George H.W. Bush a racist, right? They went after George W. Bush. With Donald Trump, it was a little easier for them. But now they're going to go after any Republican, anyone in academia. The goal is to label and smear anyone who's a Republican or a conservative with this scarlet R. They are
I'm very much Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to David French's commentary in the coming months and years now that he and other Never Trumpers got what they wanted. Paul Kanger, professor of political science at Grove City College in Grove City, PA, contributor to the American Spectator, author of The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception, and Infiltration. Paul, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
All right. You guys take care. God bless.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. It is Open Mic Friday, where we take your calls and comments, concerns, compliments, critiques, conspiracy theories, whatever you got.
And I have some breaking news. I'm PO'd right now.
That's breaking news.
Well, no, not that. No, this is the news. Governor Pritzker's press conference today is going to be virtual. Just got an email out of an abundance of caution.
Of course.
The press conference is going to take place virtually today. Now, I don't know. I mean, in the House, there was one person in the state rep who had tested positive for COVID and one in the Senate. But I think that's a little bit ridiculous. He didn't.
Well,
even
we're
walk
waiting with bated. Yeah. We're waiting with bated breath for Governor Jellybelly to weigh in on Mayor Triple Threat's comments that maybe it's time to start talking about reopening restaurants at some fractional capacity. And again, Jellybelly had said that today is the day that he would make some pronouncement about where restaurants can ostensibly open for those who are paying attention to what he has to say still.
And it's not only restaurants. It's youth sports, travel sports. It's capacities at gyms, at group classes. It's a lot more than just restaurants. And if you're not in the room, if you're not there, first of all, they're not going to ask my question. Second of all, there's no follow-up questions. He could say whatever he wants, and then nobody could, you know, press him on that issue.
Yeah, that's
it's
what happens.
It's just craziness, because
anyway.
This is not about cases now, folks. Positivity rates, get rid of that garbage. Evers isn't doing it. Whitmer isn't doing it. The governor of Indiana is not doing it. Just get rid of this. It should be about hospitalizations and availability of ICU beds. Who cares? You can have the positivity rate could be 20%, but who's in the hospital for it? Who cares? When did this come from cases? Or from, you know, flattening the curve from hospitalizations to now cases. We can't get our life back. Our kids can't get their lives back.
6-7 months ago is when it...
They keep changing, moving the goalposts. It's ridiculous. And if he doesn't deal with the high school sports issue, he's done, because Lakefront liberals, North Shore liberals are starting to hate him. And he's not going to win in 2022. If he does not address this issue this week, he's out.
Yeah, that's so much wishful thinking. Jessica in Evanston, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I just wanted to call about the Evanston District 65 superintendent's response to at least two parents, calling them white supremacists for wanting their kids back in school. I'm a taxpayer here, have two kids, and it's outrageous. We're paying for empty school buildings. To my knowledge, Evanston District 65 is the only school district in the area that hasn't put kids back in school since March, young kids, K-8 kids. It's outrageous, and he needs to be removed from his position immediately, fired and removed.
Well, how offended are you because parents ask now they're white supremacists?
Well, yeah, exactly. And I should say, too, we pulled our kids out of the public schools in July, and we're homeschooling this year because we thought this back and forth might happen, the stringing parents along, the saying they were going to do one thing and then doing another. They just had no plan, and we couldn't leave our kids' education in the hands of leaders that don't know what the flip they're doing. So the board actually needs to resign as well as Dr. Horton. We're furious.
Thanks for the call, Jess. Yeah, just to refresh, we talked earlier in the program. Some of the communications from, he's not a doctor, by the way, he's a superintendent, he's a bureaucrat, part of the nomenclatura nobody special, in other words. So the guy who is the head of the school district and then the school board members, just to give you a little bit of a flavor for what they had to say to the public. The superintendent, I want to be clear about our efforts to fight the pandemic of racism that has taken just as many lives as COVID-19. That's a statement that you really have to let wash over you a bit. He continued, we will not stop. We will continue to provide equity training for our staff. We will continue to diversify our workforce. We will continue to build an anti-racist curriculum. That means racist. We will continue to build learning environments where all students can thrive and be their authentic selves. They just can't come to school. And the school board president did the same thing. In the past 6 months alone, we've experienced different yet in very personal ways the workings of white supremacy, the way that it is weaponized against our black leaders and any of us that are committed to prioritizing the needs of black and brown children. You disagree with them. You lodge any objection, even if you're a pediatrician, which parents, pediatricians who have kids in those schools did, then you're just a white supremacist. We don't have to listen to you. Nah, 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 nah. White supremacists, we're going to continue doing what we're supposed to do because we're better than you. Shut up. Okay. Oh, and
there's also a school district in
Keep those checks coming.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right. Also, there's a school district in Washington in a small town where people ask about the mental health of their children, and the superintendent goes, you know, those are voices from people with white privilege. So only white people's kids, you know, when you ask about mental health challenges that these draconian lockdowns have against our children, then that's white privilege. It's the world we're living in.
Charlotte in Arlington Heights.
Wow, that's the Uber Munchkin line. Charlotte, call back.
Ask Charlotte to call back.
Wow, that was really bad.
Mike in Schaumburg.
Whoever, hi, good morning. Whoever Trump supports for presidential candidate in 2024 should run a platform called Honest Voting. A commission ought to be formed on how to do this, and I hope this is the first of many conversations on the topic. My contribution is I think we ought to move to electronic voting nationwide. An honest vote tally can be gotten if you have a log file of authenticated ballots electronically. Both parties can have a machine that counts them, and if there's a discrepancy, they can be gone through hand by hand, one at a time, electronically traced to see where the discrepancy is. We seem to have a fetish for paper ballots, and if you think about, or as I think about it, when you take a look at what's gone wrong, it's been due to paper ballots going through the mails, sent out willy-nilly. I think all federal offices, Congress, Senate, and President, ought to be totaled up nationally by each state submitting these authenticated ballots, and then both parties can count them.
All right, thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate it. Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. I just got a couple things on the mask. And when I see like the Mask Family Robinsons out there, you know, would have mom and dad and kids with masks on, I honestly think that's child abuse because these kids are going to be psychologically damaged. But then, like myself personally, I don't wear a mask anywhere I go, but I do keep one of those blue ones in my pocket that's got to be 8 months old. It's the dirtiest, filthiest thing you've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Don't put it on you.
Yes. Well, no, and they go like, when I go into a store and I do get one of the enthusiasts to tell me, oh, you got to have a mask. I'm like, you're right. So I'm taking it out. I'm like, it's all about saving lives and we're in this together and America's strong and some other hashtag gibberish I can't remember. And I'll drop it underground accidentally. And as I'm picking it up, I'm like, what's that on my shoe? And I'll wipe the shoe. And then I put it on. I go, are we feeling safer now? And then I walk past them and they just have that dumb blank look that only a COVID enthusiast can muster. And I'm actually shaking my head at how sad this country is with these easily controlled, easily frightened children.
Yeah, I got to tell you.
Anyhow, you guys.
Oh, Rick, ahead. Well, I see, because I've got the same, you know, family across the street, parents, kids that are 2, 3, and 4, and they're fully masked outside by themselves. And I always say, oh, I see we're in full panic mode today. That's my new line. It's my new line. And feel free to use it on anybody.
I sure will. Okay, well, thank you. You can have a good weekend.
Take
Thanks,
care.
Rick. Perry and Niles.
Good morning. I know you guys always are doing stuff, so I don't have to. So I did something, so you didn't have to. I saw the front page of the Chicago Sun-Times today.
Yeah.
And there's a picture of Joe Biden on it, and it appears that he has a halo. And I want to know if that... Did you see? Oh, you saw it, huh? I want to know, is that against the law? Because that's subliminal advertising, isn't it? And can we expect more of it?
Oh, so you suggest that, well, it's against the law because the apparatchiks that run the AFL-CIO Times are normally separation of church and state, so anything that has a religious connotation should be illegal. Is that why you're suggesting it's against the law?
Oh God! You're putting so many words in my mouth. I gotta hang up and sort them out. Thank
right,
you.
Thanks, Barry. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. Always good to talk to you. Another weekend, another one for the history books. I've got 2 comments. First question for you, Dan. Do you know if President Trump will be offering any closing remarks, possibly in a nationwide address on January 19th?
I don't know if he will or not. I think he should. I actually penned some for him a month ago when I was, and I was excoriated for even suggesting he be prepared for this to not go his way. But I think he should. I think he should attend the inauguration, but I don't know if he will.
I have a comments for him. Might he offer some conciliatory statement to President Biden, offering, as I as a builder have constructed a great foundation and structure for you to complete. I trust you will be build upon and not demolish what I constructed, including Project Warp Speed, all of my peace initiatives, and my other great accomplishments. And finally, I hope you will garner the support of the media in the opposition party as to what they offer for what they afforded me in my administration.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bob. Terry in Rogers Park.
Yeah, I hope something can be done to stop schools and universities from teaching children to hate America's history. It deserves to be honored, not condemned.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Dawn in Plainfield.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I think that woman who was complaining about her superintendent should run for her school board.
Yep.
But I wanted to let her know the next time he says something about discrimination, a question you can ask him is why, when a child has a disability, that they're not placed in a regular general education classroom. It's a real problem in this state. Other states like Wisconsin do not do this. So these people who, you know, like Governor Pritzker, who claim that they're for the people and protection, they're really full of it. And I'm telling you what, parents are fed up. And that's one positive thing from COVID, that they realize that the school system really thinks the parent is the fool. And
yes.
I'm really tired of it.
Dawn. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but that was a good place to end. That's a good point. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. That electronic voting comment leaves a bad taste in my mouth. And then on a related topic, thank you once again for providing excellent public health information, because based upon the toilet seat story that you guys talked about earlier.
It's so imperative to have toilet seats.
Yeah, we're putting all of our toilet seats back on. We had removed them, and we're using them for food prep and serving trays over the holidays to unmask this event.
Yeah.
Nobody seemed to notice, but it was very, very good. And
you should really sign up for the San Francisco Teachers Union newsletter so you can stay apprised of these things.
I should. Maybe you'll get that information to me. I'll be looking for it.
Also use toilet seats as rackets. Yeah.
Thanks for the call,
but speaking of Emily Landon, by the way, Dr. Emily Landon, you remember her, just tweeted out, there are numerous emerging COVID variants that are more contagious, meaning less exposure leads to more infection. If found in Chicago or Illinois, opening bars and restaurants is even more dangerous. need urgent financial support to be able to stay closed, exclamation point. What is she? She doesn't know squat about squat. There are other variants. Yes, like there's other variants of the flu. You know, you have influenza A and influenza B. And there's nothing to suggest that the vaccines that we're using right now don't squash all different variants of COVID. And she knows better than that. She's so irresponsible. She just wants to stay relevant, Dan, because she doesn't want this to go away, because then people won't know who she is and she can't perform her acts of bravery in front of thousands of people in Illinois.
Charlotte in Arlington Heights.
I just wanted to mention Joe Biden opened his presidential campaign, calling the president of the United States a white supremacist. Quite a high note. I think it was divisive. I think it encouraged the BLM and Antifa protests. Not a very noble way to start a presidential campaign. Call your opponent a white supremacist. And I guess he didn't have to discuss issues like packing the Supreme Court or adding new states like Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico. Anyway, you get the idea.
Yeah, not a lot of nobility to go around these days. Also, you're right. It's going to be exciting to learn what Joe Biden's position is on packing the Supreme Court and some of the other agenda items of the socialists, given that he didn't have to answer. Hey, I don't want to answer that question because people will criticize me, which is an interesting position for a presidential candidate to take and actually get away with. So now after January 20th, it's going to be exciting times as we find out what Joe Biden's actual positions are. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Yes. Morning, Dan and Amy. We know that the president's been attacked even before he became president. My question is, how does he go forward now if he is impeached again? And all of these people that have been attacking him, the late night, the media, and so forth, are they going to be as fair with Joe Biden? Are they going to ask hard questions like they did to the president? Or are they going to kiss this guy's ass for 4 years? Because if they are, I need to buy stock and you need to buy stock and chapstick, because that'll be the highest selling item in the country. I just want to thank you. I just want to thank you for your voice every day and your honesty. Whether we agree with you or not, I hope that we're going to be on in the years to come and we're not silenced by the nerds.
Thanks for the call, Rich. Appreciate it. Janice in Morocco, Indiana.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I feel that the peaceful, I say again, peaceful demonstration in D.C. was a spark of encouragement during these crazy times for all of us who want to protect our constitutional rights. And the thousands and thousands, the 99.9% who gathered peaceably, I call them patriots, not protesters.
All right. Thanks for the call. And to close out the week,
aww,
a difficult week, close it out with Chuck from Delavan.
Chuck.
I can't believe I got through. Me and my girl usually go out dancing like 3 times a week. We ain't been doing much of the dancing, so I've been trying to lose weight and due to hip-hop abs. I set out to lose 10 pounds a couple weeks ago. I just weighed myself. I've got 15 more pounds to go. everybody should get up here to Wisconsin, man. It's wide open. I'm telling you, have fun. Walk around Lake Geneva, holding hands, look in each other's eyes, and tell your girlfriend you love her.
Aww.
See you later.
All right. Ending on a note of love, as only Chuck from Delavan can provide. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.